of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the August issue of Our State Magazine, which is entitled The Lunch Break, and which features articles about favorite lunch spots around the state. Our first article is entitled The Burger Queen. Sorry about that. Everyone in Wilmington knows the name Winnie. The late wartime welder was a real-life Rosie the Riveter who went on to feed the port city. The journey to the best burger in Wilmington, according to the late Winnie Hansley Swanson Walker, began during World War II. In 1941, the North Carolina Shipbuilding Company set up shop at the Port of Wilmington, tasked by the U.S. government with building vessels during the early days of the war. At 20 years old, Winnie went to work at the shipyard. She began as a tool checker and quickly graduated to welder, spending thousands of hours hidden behind a welding hood and showered in sparks as she helped construct vessels in the global fight against fascism. As one of the many women who'd contributed to the world war effort, she was inspired to keep working. And as peace settled, she got to it. She served and managed at diners and drive-ins across town, including the once-beloved Chick Chick Grill, gaining the experience she needed to open her own. In 1957, with the help of Chick Chick owner James Merritt, she opened Winnie's Drive-In at the corner of 16th and Dawson Streets. Back then, a woman couldn't get a business loan or lease property without the help of James. So without the help of James Merritt, there'd be no Winnie's, said her granddaughter, Wendy Fincher Hughes. By 1962, Winnie had closed the drive-in and bought a block on Burnett Boulevard, a dozen paces from the Port of Wilmington. Her patch of land included a trailer park and a bar that would become Winnie's Tavern. The tavern drew daughter Jean into the mix and eventually captured the third and fourth generations, Wendy and her children, Jessica and Owen Hughes. Today, Winnie's Tavern is a far cry from the smoky bar its namesake opened. Where it once served mostly port workers, these days it's full of families and couples and gaggles of college students with only a few port workers in sight. Still, the soul of the place is anchored to its roots. In the parking lot, flecks of quartz send up Morse code flashes amid the gravel, grit, and loose change. At the far end of the lot, the strata of Winnie's history shows. Among the rocks and modern bottle caps lie pull tabs, relics of beers 50 years gone by. It's a Winnie's tradition, Wendy explains. Back when the beers were 35 cents, a lot of change was dropped in the parking lot. Every morning, this guy would come around with his metal detector and dig holes out there as he hunted for nickels and dimes. Wendy said, "I'll fix him," and tossed every pull tab and bottle cap they had in the parking lot. The family continues that ornery tradition, even though most sales are done by card, rendering loose change as much of a relic as a pulled tab. Winnie would be proud. She was tough, her strength and independence forged in the shipyard during the war, and she didn't suffer fools. "Do you know why we don't carry PBR?" Owen asks. "As I heard it, there was a guy who used to come around, and my great-grandmother didn't like him. PBR was all he drank, so she refused to sell it so he wouldn't come around. It worked, and we still don't carry PBR. I don't think we ever will. No PBR by the can and none on draft. In fact, there's no beer on draft and no soda fountain. Why? Tradition. Winnie preferred canned Coke to fountain, and draft beer went away once kegs grew too cumbersome for Winnie or Jean to move. So to this day, soda and subs are served exclusively in cans and bottles. Winnie's presence extends beyond bottle caps and single-serve sodas. Out of sight behind the bar, her mini baseball hat. Bat. Mementos celebrating her drive-in hang on the wall. There are life rings stenciled with the Port of Wilmington, North Carolina, Ocean Star, Wilmington Dell, and USS North Carolina, BB-55, among them. The city of Wilmington license plates City of Wilmington license plate adorn a few walls, the product of Winnie's Win at a city auction. The prize? 27 boxes of Wilmington license plates, some 2,500 in all. Their story is preserved in the November 11, 1984 edition of the Sunday Star News. Mrs. Walker, who owns Winnie's Tavern on Burnett Boulevard, said she will sell the license plates for souvenirs. Many seamen who come into Wilmington's state port stop by Winnie's for a beer or two. They all want a memento of the city, she said, and license plates are popular. It will be a true blue souvenir, she said. The boys off the HMS Bristol stole mine and my husband's. Today, Owen is the keeper of his great-grandmother's collection. I have a ton of those license plates, he says. She used to trade them to sailors, sell some, and give others away. I'm keeping that family tradition going. Each generation has piloted Winnie's Tavern as best they could. Under Winnie, it was a smoky old bar with pinball machines, a pool table, and shuffleboard, Wendy says. She recalls that when Jean stepped in to help, there was a bit of a hands-off. If it ain't broke, philosophy to management. By 2006, when Winnie died, and in 2016, when Jean followed, the place felt dated. Winnie's Tavern had grown apart from its drive-in progenitor, and as the demand for food increased, Owen recalls running the place as something like chasing a snowball downhill. Wendy saw a chance to change things, to bring Winnie's into the future. With her kids' help, she did. More than family connected them to Winnie's, Owen and Jessica had a financial stake in the place. Jean, seeking a legacy, had made her grandkids part owners. I was in middle school, like 14 or 15, and I'm co-owner of a bar and a restaurant, Owen says. It was a little more normal for my sisters. My sister, she's 5 years older, but it changed the way we thought about the place. He continues, my grandmother Jean helped Winnie. My mother helped Winnie in the last years of her life, then joined Jean in the business. My sister and I are part of that chain, and we shared the, if Mom's doing it, we're doing it too, attitude. When Mom said, it's time to remodel, we pitched in. Under Wendy, Winnie's Tavern evolved. Smoking indoors was out, giving her the opportunity to steer Winnie's back toward her grandmother's original drive-in dreams. The family cleaned the place, got rid of the pool table, and repainted inside and out. For the interior, they chose Battleship Gray as an homage to Wilmington's shipbuilding past. They turned Winnie's into more of a restaurant than a bar. At first, some of the regulars resisted, seeing the changes as taking away their Winnie's and not recognizing that it was time for the tavern to become a place everyone wanted to go, Owen says. But the changes worked. Corey Priest, the Cape Fear foodie at WECT News, moved to Wilmington as a transplant from West Virginia. He found Winnie's when he asked his new coworkers to recommend a lunch spot. The thing about Winnie's is it's a cozy spot where you immediately feel welcome, like you've been there 100 times before, even if it's your first visit. From his initial first meal to the most recent, that feeling of belonging has only grown. One thing that's never changed is the bragging rights Winnie earned for her burgers. She and Jean were never shy about telling everyone they had the best in Wilmington. As a teenager, it made Wendy self-conscious. I don't know why I found it so embarrassing, she said. Now I do the same thing. Tell everyone I meet, we serve the best cheeseburger in town down at Winnie's. They're not smash burgers that dominate so many menus everywhere. This is what I call a backyard burger, Priest says. A massive patty, sesame seed bun, thick-cut onion and tomato, crisp lettuce. It's the best version of what you'd get at a backyard cookout. His favorite is the Trailer Park Burger, a half-pound patty topped with fried green tomatoes, jalapeno pimento cheese, smoked bacon, lettuce, onion, bread and butter pickles, and chipotle mayo. It's a tribute to the trailer park Winnie owned and the perfect taste of the South, Wendy says. Cookbook author Fanny Slater even sang the Trailer Park Burger's praises on the cooking channel's The Best Thing I Ever Ate. Winnie's work ethic, passed down through the generations, continues to guide her granddaughter and great-grandchildren. She'd be proud of us, Wendy says. We really care about what we do, and our dive bar history is just as important as our reputation for having the best darn cheeseburger in Wilmington. The nostalgia and vibe make the experience. You can't find that everywhere, and we owe so much of that to Winnie. Winnie's Tavern is located on Burnett Boulevard in Wilmington, and they have a They have a website. Of course, it would be called wilmingtonsbestburger.com. That's wilmingtonsbestburger.com. Our next article is Keeper of the Flame. For decades, Denise Doyle was one half of a legendary diner duo. Now she's busting out new moves. For someone who's long carried a torch, Denise Doyle glides like a ballroom dancer in her white Keds. She swings through her restaurant's kitchen, rings up a customer, and hugs a friend while sidestepping the pair of fire hydrants near the door. The hydrants, each weighing about as much as a baby elephant, are the heftiest of the firefighting memorabilia stuffed into Barry's Cafe. Helmets and toy fire trucks line shelves. Hours of departmental insignia patches decorate the walls. Somehow, someone carried fire hydrants here, Denise said with a shrug, hazel eyes amused beyond wide glasses. People were always bringing things to Barry. That would be Denise's late husband, Barry Doyle, the founder of the restaurant in Wake County's Swift Creek community. In many ways, it's a classic diner, serving lunch and all-day breakfast amid red checkered tablecloths, paper napkins, and the sizzle of a busy grill. But soon after opening, Barry added a special ingredient, his devotion to firefighters. He began hauling hot food to first responders on emergency calls, sometimes with Denise riding shotgun. Though Barry died 8 years ago at age 64, the faithful still come in with memorabilia. So do the firefighters. Titus Brown first strode into Barry's Cafe more than 30 years ago. Back then, he was a captain at the Raleigh Fire Department and volunteered at the Swift Creek Volunteer Fire Department, no more than 300 yards away. If it were up to me, he said, I'd throw all of this away, said the impish silver-haired Brown, 85, side-eyeing the mountains of memorabilia. Because you got to keep it all dusted, that's a lot. No one knows this as well as Denise. She's now 70, and Barry's death left her at the center of a four-alarm life emergency. Today, the restaurant is a tribute to her husband's legacy and her own perseverance. Denise met Barry on a first date, his first date with her roommate. It was 1977, and they were all students at East Carolina University. Barry was tall, dark, and inquisitive, and he came by Denise's apartment to pick up her roommate, who was running late. Denise and Barry made small talk. The ensuing day was brief. Within a half an hour, the roommate came back home. The initial conversation had not gone well, and Barry, always decisive, had called the whole thing off. Soon after that, he asked Denise out. Denise resisted, but Barry persisted. Denise finally agreed. 2 years into their courtship, he began proposing. In 1979, on the third try, Denise gave in. They were married 6 months later. At that point, Barry was working in construction until he fell through a soft patch of roof. As legend has it, still flat on his back, he opened his eyes and declared, I need a new line of work. Barry gravitated to hospitality, drawn by the chance to, as Denise puts it, mingle with people while giving them something they wanted. In May of 1992, he debuted his eponymous cafe at the then shiny new Swift Creek Shopping Center. Denise pulled double duty, pitching it at the restaurant and maintaining her career as a sales rep in the media business. At first, Barry's Cafe leaned into real 50s soda shop vibe, complete with a jukebox blasting Elvis and Wooly Bully. But then the staff and volunteers up the hill at the fire station started marching in. Among the first were Brown and the firefighter, Bryant Woodall. The first time we came in, Barry burned the eggs, Brown says with a chortle. Had to throw them away. I thought, this guy's never going to make it unless he hires a cook. Barry hired a cook, but a certain quirk of his would never change. He liked everybody and talked to everybody, Woodall says, but he always had a special interest in the fire service, in how we did what we did and why we did it. In the winter of 1994, a vicious ice storm wreaked havoc across the South. Cars skidded and crashed. Fires erupted as people without electricity sought warmth. Emergency responders labored around the clock, duty-bound, determined, and stomach-groaningly hungry. A Swift Creek firefighter, no one is quite sure who, got in touch with Barry to see if he could feed and fuel his team and the other emergency responders. Within a couple of hours, Barry delivered biscuits, coffee, and good cheer. After that, he just kept doing it, Denise says. He felt called by God to help. A major house fire? Barry carted food to the scene. Painstakingly dredging a lake, Barry not only showed up, but he spent the night and cooked on cue. He installed an emergency scanner at the restaurant, and when the Swift Creek crew retired a 1961 pump rig, Barry bought it and turned it into a food truck long before those roving smorgasbords became de rigueur. News purveyors from Carrie Living to People chronicled his exploits. Many of the faded clips now line the cafe's walls behind framed glass. Denise joined Barry on some calls, but she had a plateful of other duties. She tended to her sales career and the couple's daughter, Catherine, their only child. Occasionally, she'd make a crucial adjustment to the cafe's operations. Barry had once offered a 50% discount to all firefighters. Denise looked at the books and trimmed it to 15%. They were complimentary, says Peg O'Connell, a longtime customer, about the couple she came to hold dear. Barry loved running a restaurant, being out front, but Denise was always there helping to make sure they kept a roof over their heads. Barry's last call came in March of 2017 when a downtown Raleigh apartment building bloomed into flames, and he arrived to feed and fuel everyone there. Barry was sick with a condition known as idiopathic neuropathy, which attacks the nervous system. A month later, he died at home. By then, much had changed. Fire departments had established formal procedures for fetching vittles, largely eliminating the need for a well-stocked Good Samaritan. In the late 1990s, Barry, Denise, and others had organized the Feed the Firefighters Foundation to provide food and beverages to firefighters and other personnel on-site at emergencies. A year after Barry's death, the foundation created an endowment to help local residents pay for the certifications and training they needed to become a firefighter in Wake County. At Barry's Cafe, Denise got even busier. Retired from her day job, she now had to answer the restaurant's call of duty on her own. At first, she struggled, especially during the pandemic. "I prayed a lot," she said, "read a lot of Proverbs and Psalms." Her Methodist minister offered support. "Denise, your identity has always been as Barry's wife, or Catherine's mother," he told her. "It's time to reinvent yourself." Denise took up golf and, like most mortals, founded a test of faith. "I'm not good," she admits, "but I enjoy being outside." She began painting, specializing in landscapes. She started ballroom dancing and discovered she was a natural. At Barry's Cafe, she seems to float in her white keds as she moves lithely from kitchen to cash register. On the dance floor, she tangos in pink heels with rhinestone buckles. In a way, her husband's cafe calling had helped set the stage for her own reinvention. After 2 years of classes at an Arthur Murray studio, Denise ventured far from North Carolina to a glittering dance showcase in Rome. There, draped in a bejeweled black gown, she danced the waltz, the rumba, and the cha-cha. On her dance card last month, a showcase in Prague. There's also a new man in Denise's life. "He's 2.5 feet tall," she says, "doesn't have all his teeth, and lives near Houston." That would be Timothy, her 3-year-old grandson. Catherine is all grown up and ventured west last year for work. Every few months, Denise jets out to dote on the brood, which now includes granddaughter Elizabeth, who's just a year old. Every November, she hosts a fundraiser for the Feed the Firefighters Foundation, and every 6 weeks, she makes sure the restaurant's memorabilia gets dusted. With summer in full fettle, Denise knows another buffing is due soon. "Seasons change," she said, "in nature and in our lives." Back at the cafe, Michael Hudson is stationed at the grill, ready for the lunch rush. He's the seasoned cook whom Denise promoted to general manager about a year ago. He flips another burger while hostess Jill Grant gaily seats another customer. Their work frees up Denise to focus on a young lady who's frequented Barry's Cafe since she was a tyke. She's now planning her wedding reception, and for her big celebration, she wants Denise to whip up a batch of the delectable chocolate chip cookies the restaurant served in its early days. "I've got the restaurant somewhere. I'll find it," Denise assures her. Between dance rehearsals and golf rounds and cafe check-ins, she knows she'll find the recipe. This is life after Barry. While even the most brilliant fires eventually extinguish, embers rekindle, new passions spark, or, as Denise pausing for just a moment at the counter, puts it, "You're allowed to have a pity party, but you can't stay long." Barry's Cafe is located at 2851 Jones Franklin Road, Raleigh, and they have a website, barryscafe.com, barryscafe.com. Next article is A Good Day's Lunch. In the middle of a long day of farming, fishing, or hunting, North Carolinians looking for a filling meal count on country stores to get the jobs done. One of the more concerning aspects of modern life is that we're rapidly moving toward a time in which no one will know what the heck hoop cheese is. You may, in fact, not know what hoop cheese is. To which I would reply, don't admit that to anyone. Just keep reading. Hoop cheese is a simple cow's milk cheese whose ingredients are pretty much that, cow's milk. The dense orange-yellow cheese is sealed with red or black wax and housed in cylindrical wooden molds, gajillions of which once adorned the sales counters of a gajillion country stores. It was cheap, handy, and filling, which meant a chunk of hoop cheese was a central figure in a nearly long-gone repast, the store lunch. Not a box lunch, not a takeout tray, not exactly road food, which could be a barbecue sandwich or even a smoked turkey leg that you could eat in a driver's seat since you only need one hand to work the steering wheel. A store lunch. It's what folks ate at the store between a hard morning of stump hauling, ditch clearing, tobacco topping, woods burning, quail hunting or bass fishing, and a hard upcoming afternoon of the same. It wasn't a packed lunch either because you had to buy something from the store. Otherwise, you'd feel right guilty sitting on the mercantile's wooden front porch rocker, three-legged stool, or worn pew from the old Pentecostal church down the road. You didn't have to buy all your lunch store at your store lunch at the store. You could bring an apple you plan on slicing with a three-blade old-timer, or even a can of sardines from home. But some financial traction had to take place to make things right. So you bought an orange crush or an oatmeal cookie to fill out the menu, and an isosceles triangle of hoop cheese the fellow carved for you at the checkout counter, just like those fancy steakhouses carve your prime rib at the table. While there was no accepted definition of a store lunch, there are accepted guidelines. A store lunch is something you get to get you through the rest of your day quick and cheap. You ate it in the cool shade of a country store, on your tailgate, or perhaps halfway on the run because the irrigation pump was almost out of gas or the bulldozer guy was due to show up any minute and time was a-wastin'. Sardines and saltines, nabs, peanuts poured down the throat of a long-necked Coca-Cola. The beauty of this meal, wrote the dearly departed Jerry Leith Mills, former UNC English Renaissance professor and chronicle of all that is good and holy about the South, lies partly in its simplicity. Everything needed in the way of place setting are a knife blade and a knee to balance cans on, and partly in its comprehensive nutrition, combining as it does the four major food groups, fat, sodium, sugar, and dirt. Jerry Leith Mills knew what hoop cheese was. I'll take your money on that. I don't want to sound like that guy, that old guy, but a typical lunch these days is something a mule farmer of old would have stretched out for a week of groceries. And folks have gotten downright fancy when it comes to a midday meal. Forget the lowly Spam on a Ritz cracker, much less the meat and three. A Ritz cracker? Now you're getting above your raisin. Everything these days is artisanal, which is hipster speak for the way my grandmother made it. I don't want anything chic. If there's a microgreen within a half mile of my bologna on white, count me out. I'm not seeking an experience. I'm just hungry. Nothing was elevated about a store lunch except its inherent simplicity and its psychic attachment to a good day's work. Oof, I really do sound like that old guy. I'm still partial to some of the honored staples of the store lunch. Tinned meat I can take or leave, but don't get between me and a pop-top can of Beanie Weenies. That's a bit of a catch-all term, but the one to look for is the venerable Van Camp's brand with all those fun, luscious E's in the name, Beanie Weenie. More than once, I've sliced my tongue slurping up the last of the short can's gelatinous goodness, and they are inspected for wholesomeness by U.S. Department of Agriculture. It says so right on the can. Practically a salad, but call them beans and franks, and I'll chase you back to polenta land. Fake grits, if you ask me. If you're a calorie counter or get all judgy over nutritional supplements such as nitrates, you'll have slim pickings in the store lunch aisle. There's just no way around it. The trick is to shift your perspective. A can of Vienna sausages is a tiny nuclear power plant you can hold in the power of your hand, in the palm of your hand. Depending on the brand, up to 10 grams of protein are packed into those little fellers. Granted, each of those grams is bobbing in a half gallon of sodium, but hey, you need salt when you sweat, and sweat is what the rest of this day has in store. And Viennas in barbecue sauce? That's nirvana. You'd best stand back. A belly full of those, and I could clear Pisgah with a chainsaw. There are yet places in North Carolina where the store lunch is still a thing. Greenville is the epicenter of a miracle called cheese biscuit, most of which are hefty enough to anchor the Queen Anne's revenge. If you can't get your afternoon done, work done on a cheese biscuit and cheer wine, you have too much to do. When I roll into a country store, I ignore the ubiquitous hot dog rollers. They've infiltrated every corner of the country like fire ants and are just as welcome. I'd rather lick a power socket than eat one of those things. But people have to make a living, so I no longer hold such businesses in contempt. If they have hoop cheese on the counter, I can forgive any number of transgressions. You have to rummage around sometimes and worm your way to the back shelves. That's typically where they keep the store lunch items, deviled ham and potted meat and other comestibles God made for good people. You might even find some dusty Slim Jims hanging on, the real ones, made in good old Garner before the plant closed down. You have to prove your mettle, I suppose. Some country store owners don't want a run-of-the-mill Raleighite from the inside the Beltline gunking up the cash register up front. Is that cheese old? Do people really eat pig's feet? These days, they need the business or they'd run such folks off the porch with the hard end of a whisk broom. It's almost easier to tell you what to avoid when you're on a hunt for a store lunch. If the store lunch has the word old in it, you can bet it's not. Run like the mad donkey it's after you. Ditto if it sells firewood in a plastic net bag. If the words worms, grill, or feed appear out front, then stand on your brakes, cowboy. Time to eat. Stick your head in the door and look around. If you can use the same $10 to pay for an oil filter, wrench, and pickled eggs in beet juice, you're likely in the right place. Well, we'll wrap things up with Welcome to Our State, which is a new section of the magazine. And this is about Thomas Wolfe Memorial in Asheville. This 1883 Victorian with its yellow clapboard siding, original stained glass bay windows, and gabled roof doesn't just have character, it is a character. The great American novelist Thomas Wolfe spent much of his childhood here at Old Kentucky Home, having moved in at age six years old with his mother when she bought the local boarding house. The property was renamed Dixieland, and Wolfe's first and most famous novel, Look Homeward, Angel. The thinly veiled autobiography paints a colorful, scandalous portrait of Wolfe's hometown and its people and caused quite a stir when it was published in 1929. Today, Old Kentucky Home is a state historic site that pays tribute to the writer's literary legacy. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.com. Thank you to Carter Glass Insurance Agency, who's the sponsor of our broadcast.